bed and I stumble to the kitchen. Pour myself a cup of ambition and yawn and stretch and try to come to life. Jump in the shower and the blood starts pumping. Out on the streets the traffic starts jumping, with folks like me on the job from 9 to 5. Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living, barely getting by.
You've joined the Betamax Video Club, rewinding back to our favourite films of the 1980s. My name's Rich Nelson and tonight I've rented 9 to 5. Watching with me is Anna Kale. Hi Anna, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I'm good. Welcome back to the Video Club so soon after Gregory's Girl.
Thank you.
We're not working 9 to 5 because it's about 7 p.m. What's so special about this movie for you?
Oh, do you know what? It's the sheer delight of it and the caper of it. I just really love it, and it's been great to revisit it for this.
I mean, I'll be honest up front, watching it 2 days ago, it was the first time I'd ever seen it, and I think it was one of those that you mentioned on social media and people go, oh my god, you haven't seen it before, how come? And I honestly couldn't give you a legitimate reason that I suppose 12-year-old me would say it didn't have Schwarzenegger or Stallone in it, but watching it now, I mean, it's almost 40 years after it came out. How, and I guess the best question to ask would be, how do you think it's aged?
Well, yeah, this is interesting. So I think it's aged pretty well, actually. I think if we'd been having this conversation a few years ago, I might not have thought that, but I think so long has passed, 40 years is a long time, that it's actually kind of, it's really kind of in its vintage now, and I think it looks great with that kind of vintage nature to it, and I think it's aged pretty well. I think things have changed, you know, and obviously I'm sure we'll cover the plot and the kind of the elements of it, but as a film I think it still looks great, and I was really surprised at how much I still enjoyed it, considering, you know, it's a long time since I'd seen it myself as well, actually.
Coming to it now as a newbie, I didn't really know a huge amount what to expect other than what was on the sort of summary on Netflix. And when you see, you know, Jane Fonda, Dolly Parton, Lily Tomlin,
yeah.
And I mean, now those three names are, I mean, they're huge even now, you know, that far along. I mean, this was Dolly Parton's first film role.
Yes.
And Jane Fonda was hugely famous anyway, and apparently fought tooth and nail to get this made. And you kind of think about, you know, even now, you know, we're in a time when we're in, I won't go on too much about it, but this that whole lockdown period, and Dolly Parton was on the TV the other night and a household name all over the world. The whole idea of the plot, in that they are, oversimplifying it, but disgruntled employees of the biggest pig male boss you can imagine. It's the kind of thing that I think a lot of people, and you don't have to work in an office, could almost relate to.
Absolutely, yeah. The basic concept of it is a great one. You know, we've either all had those terrible bosses, or we know what that would feel like. And it's a great way of kind of channeling what is kind of a serious message. There is a serious message within the film, but in a really fun way. It probably isn't what most people expect if they are seeing it for the first time. I think it would surprise a few people. You look at the concept and you think, well, how fun can that be? It really is. And I think it would surprise a few people to watch it for the first time, just how much fun you can have with it, really.
And I think it shows as well the importance of the chemistry between the leads.
Yes.
In that this film could quite easily have taken an odd turn, but it would have been very different. It certainly wouldn't have been as good if even one of the three didn't look like they were either enjoying it or doing it for, you know, they were doing it for money rather than for fun. But yeah, I mean, from start to finish, you know, these three women, you'd think they'd known each other for all their lives.
Yeah, I mean, on paper, you don't think that would work. You know, you see those names together and you think, I don't understand how that could possibly be good casting. But they're amazing together, and like you say, the chemistry is fantastic. And I understand that they gel really well on set and remain good friends, you know, years later. Yeah, I think it was inspired casting, actually. And yeah, it just really works. I think they bring so much to their roles. They're very different roles, very different characters, and I think it just really works. And that happens, you know, in real life. You find that people come together, you know, you wouldn't think they would be, you know, a good match, but you strike up a friendship with people, and it just kind of works, particularly in the workplace, I think. And I think it reflects that actually these people came together and really enjoyed themselves and really bonded making the film.
It looks like the sort of set they probably had a lot of fun on. I didn't have a chance to watch any of the extras or any sort of YouTube behind the scenes stuff, but it looks like there was probably a lot of fun to be had.
Yeah, I seem to remember watching the documentary on Dolly Parton not so long ago, and she was talking about the making of it and just how much fun they did have and how much time they spent together offset as well, kind of really bonding and kind of creating that really great friendship. And I think that really works on screen and really adds to, you know, the performances, that you can see that genuine fondness for each other that was created through spending that time together.
Yeah, I mean, my wife recently watched something she'd recorded, a documentary about Jane Fonda, following her through her various careers, and apparently this film was quite integral to certainly one or two of the episodes, because, you know, she was one of the main reasons why this film was made, you know, driving it. She, I think it was her production company that made it as well. And yes, I suppose from the beginning, she's the first woman you see. And I mean, kind of skipping over, this is one of the most, sounds weird, but probably one of the most famous movie theme tunes,
yes,
or songs of all time. And everyone's heard it, and yet not everyone's seen the film. And, you know, it's almost, I mean, you hear this more on the radio than you probably hear the theme tune to Star Wars or Jaws or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, any reference to office work or an office environment, you hear the beginning of this song, and it either clicks in your head when you're thinking about it, or it's actually genuinely used by people to kind of signify that feeling of going to work, the daily grind, the kind of the office, the mundanity of it. Yeah, it's absolutely an iconic song. You know, and I don't know whether you know any of the story behind the song itself, but Dolly Parton wrote it in an evening, after spending time talking to Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin, and, you know, kind of getting a feel for the film on set on her first day, I think it was, or something. And she went home and she wrote the song. And it's just, I mean, she's an amazing songwriter, and I could spend all of the podcast talking about how much I like Dolly Parton. I won't do, I'll try and resist that. But, you know, it's a mark of her songwriting skills that she did that and used. Part of the charm of the song is the way it uses the sounds of the everyday office to create that kind of feel of the song. So the click of the typewriter, the kind of the nails on the desk, the kind of the sounds that you hear around you, and it really evokes that feeling of, you know, the office work and the everyday the same. And yeah, I think it works so well. Yeah,
and the way it overlays the credits as the film opens, you've got, I mean, the three sort of leads, but as they're going into the city to work, it's women, pretty much all women of various issues, and there's a case of women who are in positions of power, women who are, and I've written this in a kind of, even reading it now seems a bit silly, but trying to do it all, you know, those who are juggling childcare, even little things like, you know, trying to carry all the papers and the coffee for everyone else. You know, there's women in all different scenarios, and this theme tune just almost seems like these people probably have it as a soundtrack to their working day. It's absolutely perfect song. I mean, well, it's a great song anyway, but I mean, for this, it just works absolutely 100%.
Yeah, and that, yeah, I noted down about that opening scene, obviously seeing it again and seeing so much more within the film. This is a film for every woman, and I think it, you know, that comes across from that opening scene. You're straight in it, you see every woman, you know, is going through that similar experience. And now watching it as a woman who does that very thing, I go to work every day, I juggle childcare, I do everything else, you know, it really resonates more and more now, seeing it as a woman who is in that position rather than a teenager as I was when I saw it originally. There's so much more to it, but it is, it's an every woman experience, definitely.
It's funny, I watched this with my wife, and when the three leads all wake up at 7 a.m, their alarm clocks go off, and her first thought was, my God, waking up at 7, what a treat. And again, one of the themes of the one of the things we see later on is how about flexible hours,
yeah,
and how that becomes a thing, because, you know, certainly in where I work, 9 to 5 isn't really a thing, and if it is, it's kind of labeled at you as a kind of, oh, you work 9 to 5, easy life. But, you know, working flexible hours, you know, waking up at 7 is a luxury, because some of us are already at work by then. Some of the themes that come out of this later on, and it's almost like it was made with a crystal ball, and seeing what eventually comes out of this storyline and how much of it became, I wouldn't say the norm, because a lot of people still struggle to get these basic work rights, but they're certainly being pushed. And even in developed parts of the world, you know, most large companies probably implement these things, and to some people they kind of take them for granted.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you'd think, you know, 1980, things would be pretty progressive by then, but they really weren't. And particularly not in America. America's not exactly leading the way with workplace rights even now. Well, let's face it, they're pretty behind the curve with that kind of thing anyway. And potentially in 1980, they might have been slightly behind kind of, you know, the rest of the Western world with this stuff. But even so, to look back now as a working woman, to imagine what it would have been like to not have that flexibility that a lot of us are used to. Not everybody, but a lot of people. I mean, I work in the public sector, so, you know, there's a lot of protections and rights for me as a worker and for my colleagues. But, you know, when I started work in, you know, the late 90s, it was quite different even then. And I think explaining to younger women now, or anybody, you know, when you enter in the workplace, well, it never used to be like this. It's quite an odd concept for people that within our lifetime, or within the lifetime of someone you're working next to, it wasn't like this at all. And I think it's, I think it's quite surprising to think just how far we've come. But that's only through the battles of other women who've gone before us to kind of get those concerns addressed, that, you know, that the stuff is there for us now to enjoy and benefit from.
I mean, as the film begins, we see Jane Fonda's character, Judy, be sort of led into her new office. She's newly divorced. She's got herself an apartment. This is her first real job, I suppose. Mm-hmm. I mean, as she references, you know, before this all, that sounds awful itself, all she'd been is a housewife, but that's what she'd done. You know, she'd been at home. She didn't have a normal, as you put it, job. She's very nervous, like a rabbit in the headlights at some points, and already people are pointing out the fact that she's wearing a large hat, and I don't know whether this is a reinvention sort of thing, but, you know, immediately she meets, I say, office manager of some sort, but as Violet introduces to her, there's very much these little hierarchies within the department she works in, and I suppose in any office environment there's always going to be hierarchies and cliques, and I suppose even if in this day and age that still goes on now.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I do think when Jane Fonda emerges from that lift, she reminded me, and this sounds ridiculous, she reminded me of Dustin Hoffman in Tootsie. She looks ridiculous in that hat, and it's like the outfit with the bow on the blouse, and the kind of, it's like a real kind of you know, if you were mocking what a woman in an office might look like Dustin Hoffman did in Tootsie, that's kind of what you'd imagine someone wearing. And I think it's interesting how she relaxes as time goes on, and you see that change in her outfits and the way she dresses for work, that she relaxes into working, and you kind of see her progression through the film. And I think that's really interesting how she adapts and kind of relaxes into working life so well. And you see that in the way she holds herself, you know, that confidence that she gets from that moment where she's so timid when she comes out of that lift to later on in the film. I think it's a really interesting journey that she goes on.
Hmm. We see her introduced to Mr. Hart Jr., the main villain of the piece, as it were. I mean, immediately, this guy who runs this office, I think he refers to her as damn pretty, and the other women in the office as crones.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, immediately, there's no sugarcoating the fact. You know, they're not trying to say he's misunderstood or anything. He is just an absolute dinosaur.
Oh, he is. He's an awful person. I think, obviously, for comic effect, he's quite a caricature of you know, that type of man. But unfortunately, that type of man did exist and still probably does exist within the workplace. And I think it's, it's interesting just how awful they make him. And Dabney Coleman, obviously, is wonderful as Frank. He's just, fantastic.
I mean, watching it now, it's, again, you know, with that it's not even a caveat of being 40 years later. I mean, these attitudes probably go on, and people perhaps are just better at hiding it. Maybe it only comes out on an office do's or something like that. But, you know, immediately he's asking Violet, who's one of his most senior employees, to go and buy his wife a present. You know, again, sort of sentencing her. This is a woman with, you know, high aspirations of, you know, senior management, and she's off buying a scarf on her lunch break.
Yeah, and it's very obvious that Violet is an incredibly talented woman who has been left, you know, behind and set aside because of her gender, and the way that these things work, you know, jobs for the boys and all that. And you see that in everything that she does and says, that kind of seething anger and resentment, but yet having to toe the line. And we've all been there. I remember one of my first bosses always got me to make the coffee. If someone came in for a meeting, it was me that had to go and make the coffee, even though obviously that was well outside of my job description. And it's the thing, you just kind of, you know, you're putting the sugar in the cup and you're really kind of hoping it's something else, which is why this film is so great, because it explores those fantasies and those feelings that you have and those thoughts that you have every day, and really kind of, you know, explodes them out, which is why it's so fun.
And we're also introduced to Franklin's secretary, Dora Lee, who's Dolly Parton, who, I mean, I think this is the second film I've done for this podcast with Dolly Parton, and the Steel Magnolias with the other one. And I mean, she's just like, it sounds almost patronizing, just this kind of super friendly ray of sunshine, almost too innocent to understand what's going on.
Yeah, she's wonderful. I love Dolly Parton in this, and to think that this is her first acting role, I think it's just amazing, the performance she gives. And I think what's great about her character is it's not a cartoon character. You know, she is a genuine character. She's a genuine kind of, she gives such a genuine performance, but the character is drawn really well. Yes, she is very pretty, very attractive. You know, she's a lovely, you know, young woman, and we can see why Frank, her boss, likes her. But equally, she's a really lovely person, and of all the people in the film, she's very honest. You know, she's really, you know, she really will take no prisoners in terms of, you know, the way she reacts to the situation. And I think, yeah, it's surprisingly refreshing the way that the character is explored. You know, she is not a patronized character within it. She's not there for laughs. They're all there for laughs. That's the whole point. You know, as a threesome, the three leads are equal in terms of the way that they're treated by the writing, I think. And she just gives such a lovely performance in that role. She's perfect for it. I can't imagine anybody else playing that role. I don't understand how anyone else could have done what she did with it, really.
No, I mean, I can, you know, again, she just seems to, it was almost like the part was written for her. And you know, when sometimes you get someone who's cast perfectly in a role, and yet when you look at Steel Magnolias, with the other one that I did that she was in, and even though that was only, what, 8-9 years apart, and she seems there to be this kind of, almost like a Yoda kind of, this older woman, I'll say older, middle-aged woman dispensing advice. And here, I mean, she was only, what, 33, I think I had written down, when she did this.
Yeah.
And yet still looks so innocent. And there's one scene with her husband later on where she, I would say, bemoans, but she's certainly concerned, because all of the women in this office avoid her. When she goes in for lunch, people back away and make alternative plans because they think that the boss is sleeping with her because she's an attractive blonde woman at his whim. And I guess that's kind of almost expected of a secretary at the time.
And people say she's just a big pair of tits.
Absolutely, yeah. It's a tale as old as time, isn't it? That thing of the boss and the secretary. You know, and we've all been in offices where that kind of thing does occur. Or maybe it's just places I've worked, I don't know. you know, I once worked in a place where the female boss was having an affair with the postboy. You know, these things do, you know, there's positions of power. Power is exploited, and, you know, it's kind of a secretary or someone who you work very closely with is an easy target in terms of, you know, kind of creating those opportunities. But I think she handles the situation with him, with her boss, so well. You know, it's really refreshing to see that she's not a victim, you know, and she absolutely stands up for herself, which is wonderful.
I mean, the scene where basically the boss is just engineering these situations to both leer at her and, oh, you know, physically grab. I mean, it's just, you know, pushing pens on the floor to look down her top. But I mean, it gets really quite physical towards the end, at the point that his wife walks in. I mean, again, it's funny because it's a comedy and we can look at it now thinking, oh God, yeah, what a, almost like a farce, you know, something out of a Carry On movie. But, you know, this probably still happens, and I guess at the time was probably very common. But again, Dora Lee playing it as, well, this is my job, this is what I kind of have to put up with, this sleazy geezer.
Yes, yeah.
Dora Lee.
Yes?
About my conduct in the office here yesterday, I'm afraid I got a little carried away. I'd just like to apologize to you.
Oh, don't you worry about it, Mr. Hart. I've been chased by swifter men than you, and I ain't been caught yet. Shall we get back to our letter now?
Well, yeah. But could you just come over here for a second?
The concept of having to put up with that is, it's an interesting one. And obviously, this, as I said at the beginning, there's quite serious themes within this film, which actually, you know, it's quite... Quite a kind of an achievement, that the way it balances the comedy and actually the seriousness of some of the things that they're poking fun at.
I'm sure in, you know, the last couple of years, you know, the revelations about various people in Hollywood anyway, you know, this probably rang true of a lot of them. And it's a good job this film didn't go down too dark an avenue and sort of recast with Louis C.K. in a corner somewhere. But moving on. You know, one of the next things you see is Judy struggling with a photocopier, and then the boss comes in and screams at her and has a go, and again just shows that he's not understanding at all. He hasn't gone through any sort of leadership academy.
No, and we, you know, there are so many people within organisations who rise to the top really quickly and who have no skill. And I'm sure that's a familiar story for many people listening to this podcast. You know, these people, you know, even, you know, Violet herself says that he went through the management trainee scheme and she was the one who trained him. And it's like, oh, you know, I've been there and done that. You know, people rising to the top who you've interviewed or you kind of, you know, you trained up, and you kind of see them and you wonder, you know, why them, you know, what are they saying that's the right thing, you know, and you kind of, yeah, that feeling of just no talent, but saying the right things to the right people or looking the right way, you know, for people to accept them. And I think, you know, unfortunately that's still the case in many places, I think.
Yeah, I mean, even for my boat, I mean, the next point where, you know, Violet has an idea that the boss poo-poos and then takes credit for it before denying her promotion, and some of the caveats that he gave, you know, like clients would rather deal with men, you know, things like that. Again, it's just so strange to watch now, but again, thinking, well, it still happens. They may not be so overt about that reason, but people taking credit for other people's ideas... I mean, that could happen with anything. It could be podcasts. But, yeah. You know, we're still in that position where she's denied a promotion on the grounds of the fact that the boss looks down on her and sees her as not an equal because she's a woman. And it's overtly sexist.
Absolutely. And I don't think you have that overt sexism now. I think people have learned to hide it and hide it well. But that kind of, yeah, that treading on people to get a foot up the, you know, the next rung of the ladder is still true. I mean, I've got a work nemesis where I work, and he's my nemesis because he stole an idea out of it. We had a conversation once, and he took an idea that I'd had and put it out on our kind of work intranet as his own. And, you know, it's like... Oh, I just, yeah, really struggled with the concept of doing that to someone. I found it quite amusing, so I've created him as my work nemesis now. You know, in the greater scheme of things, it doesn't matter. It was only a small idea, but it's the principle of the thing. You know, it's just an example of how people will do anything to to look better and kind of, you know, shine a light on themselves. And I think, yeah, that still continues, that, you know, every day in a workplace, you know, you see it all the time.
It's nice to know these things are universal no matter where you work. You know, people have work wives and work husbands, but also work nemesis. And I guess, you know, something that I've only just kind of considered, and you think about where we are now, it's 2020, and almost exactly halfway between the time that this podcast being done and the film came out, we had The Office, the Ricky Gervais show, where, you know, he is portrayed more as a moron and someone who's got a massive opinion of himself. But, you know, sitting there, I mean, his attitudes aren't as, again, overtly, and again, there isn't necessarily the malicious side of it, but there's still that office environment where people, that there is the politics and the people taking credit for other ideas, and there is perhaps also the expectation around this whole boys club kind of environment. And, you know, you think when that was made, I guess that was, yeah, maybe 20 odd years ago, how things have changed since then. But, you know, that time lapse of 20 years between 9 to 5 and The Office, you know, and you still have, admittedly, Played for Laughs again, but, you know, probably one of the most famous TV bosses, certainly in the UK. And here we are now still kind of saying, well, people are just better at hiding it.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Says a lot.
It does, I think, yeah.
I did like the part where, because, again, Dora Lee comes across, or she's told the rumour that she's the boss's mistress. And the way that, you know, because we've seen Dora Lee as this very friendly, happy, you know, sad because people aren't nice to her. And all of a sudden she kicks off talking about having a gun in her purse and telling the boss that she'll turn him from a rooster to a hen, which is just absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Yeah, she's a formidable character, really, you know, with a constant smile on her face. And I think it's really interesting.
She's not someone you'd cross.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
And we're at the part now where one of the other office employees had been sacked because the boss's spy had overheard her talking in the toilets. And again, a horrible thing. He just says, fire the bitch.
Yeah.
And really, like, spiteful. There's no friendliness there at all. And it turned out, I mean, she was talking to Judy, but she didn't recognise Judy's voice, so that's why she didn't get sacked.
Yeah.
But the three women, Judy, Violet and Dora Lee, go to a bar, and this is where we get where the film really starts to become a kind of, I would say, a heist movie almost. But there's the plotting, there's this, I mean, they're in a bar getting having a few drinks, then they go back and smoke a joint and get stoned and go off on these, my wife said they reminded of Monty Python, but there's some real elaborate fantasies about what they'd love to do to the boss, and certainly not in a good way.
Yeah, they're wonderful. I love that part of the film, actually. Those fantasy sequences are great, and I'd kind of forgotten just how pretty violent they are, actually. You know, they're really quite extreme, each one of them in its own way. Each one kind of champions the strength of the woman who's having the fantasy, and also really kind of goes to town on Frank, the boss. And it's really fun, but it's actually, you know, it's quite extreme stuff that they're fantasizing about, but it's just great. You know, it's a real the film really comes alive, I think, at that point, you know, and becomes a great caper comedy in the kind of the 80s tradition, you know, that kind of feel of films that you get around that time. I loved seeing those fantasy sequences again. I think that they're great.
They're so well written and they're so well put together. Yes, this is a film, I wouldn't even say by women, but, you know, empowering women. But this is a scene where that's completely irrelevant, because anyone can watch this and think of what they'd like to do to usually their boss.
Yeah.
And it's just so universal. You think Judy's character is that she's hunting the boss, chasing him through the office with a shotgun. And again, it's just perfect, because most of us have had a boss like that where, quite frankly, seeing his head on a wall mounted would be a dream.
Yeah, absolutely. It's there's something for everyone, I think, in this film. Anyone who's ever worked in an office or in that kind of workplace where you just want to take your frustration out on that person that makes your daily work life such a difficult thing, you know, I think anyone can relate to that, male or female, really.
Is that the sort of thing you wish you could do to your work nemesis?
Yeah, I think, I've mellowed a little bit with him. But yeah, I think, there have been times, there have been many bosses who have kind of thought, oh, do you know what? I really want to take revenge on you. Those three fantasy sequences are great because they're doing what everybody's thinking, and you can really relate to it.
Dora Lee's fantasy is dressing up as a cowgirl, and it's very much a role reversal where almost word for word she has turned the tables, where Franklin, the boss, is actually her secretary, and she sexually harasses him. At one point she sticks his face in her chest, which I guess the weird thing is that most guys would probably tell him and go, oh yeah, I'd love some of that. And then imagine having that done constantly for years and being put down for that. But being tied up and lassoed by Dolly Parton probably tick a lot of people's boxes.
I was going to say that's actually my favourite of the fantasy sequences, I think. We'll move on from that maybe.
Yes. But probably the most extravagant one was Violet's, which is essentially a Disney movie gone horribly, horribly wrong.
I can understand her. You know, she's the one who's had the brunt of it for so long as well. But it's hilarious the way that they use that. That the iconic kind of, like you say, the kind of cartoon nature of it. It's just wonderful. But the ending of it, it's like, okay, that's quite extreme.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, she has these cartoon animals like Bambi and Thumper and that, although I'm sure Disney had no say in that, but whistling away, poisons his coffee, he's got steam coming out of his ears, she chucks him out the window. It ends in this sort of glorious animated castle scene where everyone's been set free.
Yes.
It's just marvellous.
It is marvellous, yeah. It's wonderful fun, but a serious message at the heart of it, I think.
Yeah, and I guess it just shows that darkness, and unfortunately it very much foreshadows the next scene where when they all go back to work and Violet accidentally poisons his coffee.
Yeah.
Shenanigans ahoy.
Yeah, it's great, and the way it's played is wonderful as well, because you can understand it. You know, that thing where you're in the office kitchen and someone comes in and you're distracted or you're tired or you've got so much going on. I mean, Violet is, I think, I love Dora Lee, you know, she's a great character, but Violet to me is the one that I relate to the most, because, you know, that thing of so many things to juggle. There's a great scene earlier on where she's on the phone to 17 people at once and she's just getting through it and doing it. You know, you know these women, and, you know, you may be, you know, listeners are that woman themselves, or that, you know, where you're juggling so many things at once and you're just doing it and you get on with it and you just get it done, and people just assume you'll get it done. But it's so tiring, and you can understand why, you know, a little lapse in concentration, you've accidentally poisoned your boss. I mean, it might happen, you know, I can understand it. I really can.
I mean, that's what he gets for being needy and having this weird sweetener. I mean, just have sugar.
Exactly.
Come on.
He deserved it, yeah.
I mean, was it skinny and sweet, I think?
Yeah,
was
something like that.
I suppose like Canderel, but that's what you get if you put it in a box that looks like rat poison. Accidents happen.
It does. It happens all the time, you know. Who hasn't done that?
This is something that has happened a couple of times. It turns out his office chair is defective. Of course, that's Dora Lee's fault because she hasn't replaced the chair. But he falls backwards off the chair and spills the coffee. And of course, because he's bumped his head, he gets taken to hospital. And Violet's first thought, once she twigs what happened, is, oh my God, I've killed him.
Yeah.
And again, this is almost like a Weekend at Bernie's kind of film, where he gets taken to hospital and very early on, you know, they don't make bones about this, he sneaks out because he doesn't want to pay the hospital bills, just to show what a prick he is. You know, he's horrible to doctors, it's not just people he works with. But the way that this, again, and I think the word she used earlier was ideal, was caper, where it is a little bit, it's silly, but they're moving a dead body from place to place. Well, Violet's moving the dead body from one place to another. Yeah. And the other girls are just almost enjoying it. They're not, but they're kind of watching astounded.
Yeah, and it's a mark of great writing, I think, that, you know, it just really works. I mean, it sounds ridiculous, I think, you know, that is in this film, and that, you know, it becomes this kind of caper comedy, but it does it so well. It's like the pacing of a kind of, you know, a 40s comedy, you know, that kind of thing of the sparky dialogue and all that kind of thing, but equally the physical comedy of it as well, the way they move, the way they things just kind of fall into place at the right time, you know, a door will open at the right time or someone will come past and they'll kind of it's great, you know, the wrong identity kind of, you know, and people are making assumptions about someone, who someone is, and it's so well paced, you know, the writing and the direction is great, you know, in all of the film, but in that particular part in the hospital and through, you know, beyond that until they finally realize what's happened, it's just so well written and so well played, you know, that it just really works, you know, and it's a mark of a very well made and played film that just kind of just all falls into place so well. I think
the part where the young volunteer asks Violet, who's wearing the doctor's coat, you know, where's the cafeteria, and once she realizes that she's a doctor, you know, immediately pulls rank and says, "What are you talking to me for? Piss off."
What?
You're a doctor. I didn't see your badge. Sorry.
I'm a doctor. So why the hell am I talking to you? Piss off.
You know, kind of, it's almost like an automatic thing where she's put in this position of power and without even thinking about it, it's like, I'm more important than you, go away.
Yeah, power corrupts, you see.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, at least piss off was the worst thing she did. But, you know, it wasn't long after what she's asking about, where can we get our hands on some cement? You know, just to kind of really sort of go full out on this crime that she thinks she's committed. But they find out it's the wrong body and get pulled over by the cops.
Yeah.
And it's the most friendly, helpful cop ever. And they're just so horrible to this poor, lonely policeman.
They are, yeah. But it's just great. You know, again, the three leads just handle that comedic situation so well. It's just a really natural kind of, the way they work it between them is just incredibly amusing. And yeah, it's a great scene, actually.
I wonder if there's any police officers listening to this who, next time they pull over a car with women in it who are claiming they've been poisoned, will be so forgiving.
Yeah.
Just double check there's not a body in the boot.
Yeah, exactly.
So the day after, they go back to the office, and I suppose it must be like seeing a ghost, because Hart just walks in as normal, as if nothing's happened.
Yeah, it's, again, you know, we again, the audience know what's going on, obviously, before they do. So you're waiting to see the inevitable kind of showdown between them. But it's just, yeah, it's very, very funny.
The way he finds out about this, again, he's got his spy, Roz, who overhears them talking in the toilets while she's hiding in the cubicle. And he basically blackmails Dora Lee into having sex with him. I mean, she doesn't, obviously, but
no.
That he puts the plot to her. Again, like, she calls him evil and ties him up with a phone line, very much like her fantasies coming true to some extent.
Yeah, she does. It's it's quite surprising, really, actually, the way it escalates and the complicitness of all of them within that kind of situation. But it's all about coming together and doing it. The solidarity between the women kind of comes through, of dealing with that situation. You know, it's kind of, well, it's happened, let's deal with it. And it's the same with the poisoning thing, you know, the day before. They come together and they're like, well, we'll sort it between us. And they work together to kind of solve it and just get on with it. You know, again, it's that thing of kind of getting on with it and doing what they need to do, but doing it together. And I think it, you know, again, that kind of comes into play, that relationship between the three leads.
I find it funny that we talked about these fantasies as being, you know, ludicrous and very far-fetched, and I think within 15 minutes all three of them to some extent have come true, because then Judy finds Dora Lee's gun and shoots the glass out. So again, she's shooting guns in the office. So all three of them at some point have had these drug-related dreams and have come true. Maybe some kind of seance or something like that.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Yeah, it's a great way of kind of showing just, you know, the great writing of the film and the way that it just happens. It's lovely, actually.
So this is part of the plot where it starts to become, I wouldn't say too technical, but they're working out how can they shift him, how can they get him fired for some sort of misconduct or whatever he's done, because they're going to realise that, yes, they're the ones who are in trouble, but they need almost to take the bigger hit, and they're looking at having him basically dealt with for embezzlement. I mean, it's not quite Trading Places level of, you know, some knowledge of finance needed, but eventually they get round to the right idea. But yeah, some certainly more shenanigans going on with, well, what looks like a S&M sex gear.
Yeah, I kind of had forgotten about that aspect, or maybe I didn't want to know about it when I was at the age of first saw it, or didn't understand it, I should say. But yeah, it's quite quite an interesting kind of way of dealing with the boss, actually. And it's a power thing, isn't it? The S&M aspect to it. It's about the power shift, which I liked, you know, the kind of the way that they absolutely empower themselves, and he is suddenly devoid of all power, and it's really interesting the way that the tables have turned. The way they deal with the kind of the that little plot thing with the embezzlement and all that kind of thing, the thing that I loved and kind of thought about at the end, actually I didn't really think about it all the way through, but at the end I was thinking, you know, obviously the company's called Consolidated, we never actually know what they do as a company. Which I think is wonderful, you know, the fact that they're just this big, faceless corporation, and, you know, it doesn't matter what they do or what they're there for, you know, they're just there, and you don't know what you do every day, you know, what it kind of amounts to. And it's just really interesting that they kind of come up with this way of trying to kind of frame him. But yeah, it's just funny that actually, what do they do as a company? It's quite amusing that we never find out.
It's one of these industries, and I guess it's probably works quite well in TV and films, where knowing what they do probably would confuse you, but I guess the only thing you need to know is someone high up is getting really rich off their hard work.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, again, this isn't a bet, I swear, but I mean, you can call this back to, and I mention this every episode, but Superman 3, where people are kind of putting numbers from one column into another, you know, talking about moving of half cents, which make thousands of dollars. Knowing what they actually do isn't really the important thing. You just know that there is a way of making money off this. And Franklin's money is basically made off, especially hiding stock in a warehouse and selling it off and not showing it on the books. If you know what you're doing, it's probably quite well done, but I mean, they find it out. It's just a manner of, like, I suppose, like any investigation, is having to prove it with evidence.
Yeah, I sometimes think that actually is Frank really capable of coming up with that idea himself? You know, it's kind of, I do wonder, because he is a bit of a fool, isn't he?
Yeah.
Actually, did he just look out in terms of happening to kind of think about a way of kind of dealing on the side? But he's clever, but not clever enough.
They find it out, and it's only because it transpires later on that he was released from his kinky garage door mechanism, which luckily we knew that Violet could install a garage door.
Yeah, absolutely. Because she can do anything, because she's a superwoman.
Yeah, and it's a good thing they showed us that, otherwise we wouldn't have believed her. His wife, who is a very periphery character, but she's been away and comes back and lets him go, and it turns out he's been out for a few days. But this is after Judy's ex-husband turns up at the house. You know, he's left her for his secretary, just to kind of rub it in and be a full cliche. He kind of finds Franklin tied up and chained up in his room, and I suppose in 1980, accusing your ex-wife of being into bondage and sex games would have been quite the scandal.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, maybe people wouldn't bat an eyelid so much now, but yeah, certainly then, to think that your wife could enjoy sex, you know, my God, that's controversial. But yeah, it's just, again, it's a great funny scene played out, that physical comedy. You know, we wouldn't necessarily expect Jane Fonda to be in a film where, you know, that's kind of that situational comedy. You know, that I was reminded the other day, I was watching A Fish Called Wanda, and there's a similar-ish kind of scene of kind of movement of people and trying to hide, and it's great, you know, the way that they kind of move it around the house in 9 to 5 in that scene, and you're wondering, is he going to find, what's going to happen? You know, it's just, again, so well played in terms of the movement of the characters around the house to the inevitable conclusion, but the way they then play it with Jane Fonda's response to her ex-husband is just great. You know, it's a wonderful, empowering response to it. You know, she just owns it, and it's great.
I love his kind of weak at the end, sort of saying, oh, I was going to come and ask you back, but
yeah, like that's the dream for her, do you know what I mean? It's like, yeah, but she's moved on now, and it's just wonderful that she has, and she can show him that, you know, it's another victory for her and for women, that she can kind of turn around and say, oh, well, I don't need you.
Well, eventually, you know, we think that the women have kind of failed in their mission, because the as Franklin's managed to cover up what he's done with they've got these invoices that show that really he's done nothing wrong. And I suppose you kind of get, I would say, the best case scenario, but when the big boss, the chairman of the board, who is kind of referenced but never seen until this point, he turns up, and as he returns to work, Franklin is being made aware at the time of these schemes that the women have implemented while he's been away. And I suppose if I'll use the wording that he's referenced to throughout the film as the sexist, egotistical, lying, hypocritical bigot of a manager. And to find that in your however many weeks he was away, that these women who you despise so much have implemented flexible working, a daycare in the office, part-time working, job share stuff, which, you know, some of which now is just seen as almost a standard. And to be kind of outed in front of your boss. I mean, essentially, Franklin is managed upwards. He's given a promotion for stuff that he hasn't done, but it solves their problem that he's taken away from them. It's a strange sort of conclusion to the whole plot.
It is, but it's the look of fear on Frank's face when he realises the consequences of his non-actions is classic, because actually he is suffering as a result of their kind of success, you know, with, I think, profits are up 20% or whatever it is, you know, within that time. The thing that motivates the chairman of the board to think this is a great idea, it's all about money, isn't it, at the end of the day? So, you know, they're making more money, therefore these are good ideas. The look on Frank's face when he realizes promotion means, you know, what it means, i.e., you know, going to South America and living in the jungle, whatever it is, it's just hilarious. You know, he is being supposedly rewarded, but actually the look of fear on his face just says it all. You know, actually this is not what he wants, because he's out of his depth already. He, you know, he's even further out of his depth now, and, you know, all as a result of their you know, what they did in his absence, which actually is the ultimate, I guess, punishment and ultimate revenge on their part, is that he you know, actually is going to suffer longer term.
I've got some people at work I could do with that. They could maybe be found out, I suppose. But in this scenario, the fact that, and this is what a lot of big business and people, maybe, I mean, you know, me and my wife also work in the public sector, and we kind of pour scorn on people like, I don't know, Google or Facebook, where you assume that they just sit around in beanbags all day and have slides in the office and stuff, where, you know, all it is about is improving productivity and profits. Now, you know, in our industry, and profits or making money is certainly very far down the list. But because they've implemented all these things, all these schemes and all these programs, and it's kind of that crystal ball style thinking where, looking, you know, however far ahead it was at the time, by having happy employees, by having, you know, a situation where you don't have to worry about childcare, made such a big difference. And I mean, I don't think I've moaned too much about it on this podcast, but I mean, you know, our childcare for our two kids costs more than our mortgage.
Yeah.
And we're in that position now where it's just like, my God. I mean, to be fair, I wouldn't want them to take them to my work, because they just get into all sorts of scrapes. you know, when I've done it before, all they've done is been bought crisps and fizzy drink and stuff. And it's like, nope. But having the facility there to have a daycare or a creche or whatever it is, if it makes you less worried about your work and you can concentrate on it, then you get a lot more done. And I suppose if your ultimate big boss, the chairman of the board, comes down and sees this, of course you're going to think, oh, maybe if it works in this office, it could work in Brazil.
Yeah.
And why not, you know?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, the kind of, you see the benefits of, for everybody in the office, of these changes that they implement. You know, it's not just the people with the kids. I'm thinking mainly about one of my favourite characters actually in the film, I don't think we've mentioned, is the woman who's always drunk at her desk. you know, she's wonderful. I love her. She's fantastic. She's always swigging from a bottle from a locker, you know, and she said it's for medicinal purposes. You know, again, we all know people who get through the day that way. But by the end of the film, she's turned her life around because her employers have sorted out, you know, support for her. And she's going to, you know, meetings or whatever it is. And she's got that support. You know, the office environment is nice and friendly, and you're allowed a photo on your desk, and it's not the monotony and the kind of the plainness of a kind of this awful open plan office. I mean, one thing that's kind of happened in, you know, my workplace recently is there's more flexible working, you know, in terms of hours and things, but equally the flexible working about the workspace has changed. So there's a lot of hot desking, which suits some people, but other people hate, because you can't put your own personal space together. You know, your office is an extension of your life. You know, you spend so much time there. You want to make it your own, to be somewhere you're comfortable. And some of the changes that they make in this film at the end, you see that people feel comfortable and feel happy. They work more effectively. They work together and you get better results. I think it's really interesting. And obviously, there's the childcare aspect. We've talked about the flexible working and the stop the clocking in, for example, you know, and kind of people are trusted, you know, trust is a big thing in the workplace, you know, to empower people, you know, through trust is you do get better results. But it's really interesting that the one thing that's a step too far is equal pay for women. And I think that's really interesting that they make a point of that being just a little bit too far. You know, the chairman of the board is not happy with that aspect. And I think that's really telling and really interesting, actually.
Yeah, because ultimately it's about the bottom line. You can make changes all you want, but, you know, let's not go too far.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just, yeah, even in 1980, you know, within that film, within that environment, that paying women the same as men is just that, you know, a step too far. We can possibly do that.
We don't want to get them ahead of themselves.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
And again, like something you mentioned before, and I hadn't considered at the time, you know, and having recently rewatched, A Fish Called Wanda heavily then leans upon the blurb at the end where it kind of shows what happens to the main characters. Yes. At the end. Yeah. You know, and I don't want to go so far as to say it's a lift, but I mean, they're very heavily inspired by, I mean, the concept that Franklin ends up going to the Amazon and being abducted and never seen again.
Yeah.
You know, it's essentially the same as, you know, some of the endings of that film where, is it one of them goes off to, is it Cuba or something like that, I think?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
And you can have a little bit of fun and you think, well, we're abolishing the need for a sequel. We're just going to have a little bit of fun here and says, yes, all these things that we don't have to film and write, you know, here's a couple of words and you let your imagination run away with you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's interesting. Obviously, Violet gets what she rightly deserves in terms of promotion. But I was kind of disappointed with the ending, you know, for maybe not for Dora Lee, actually, because obviously, you know, it's a wonderful ending for her. But for... rather than marry a man and, you know, never have to work again, fall in love and get married and all that business, which, you know, is lovely, but surely she can work as well.
Yeah.
After battling so hard, you know what I mean?
I suppose they still, you know, this was still written in 1980.
So, yes, exactly.
Yeah, there's only so much you can fantasise. I mean, at this point we were having alien space battles and all sorts, but let's keep it real.
Yeah, I think of my mum actually when she returned to work after, because obviously, you know, her age, she's 72 and she had to give up work when she got married because that's what you had to do in those days in the late 60s. And she spent all the 70s and into the early 80s looking after children and not working. And then she got to a position where she had to go back to work and worked part time in an office. And there's a picture of her actually in 1982 or 1983 when she was in her first office job wearing dungarees and with a kind of short haircut, which really angered my dad. and kind of this thing of her, the change that she, it's probably a quite serious point actually, the change that kind of came from her entering the workplace and the empowerment it gave her to make decisions about her and the way she looked and the way that she did things was really interesting. And I think the Judy character, you're right, it was on the cusp of that kind of change. You know, she was going back to work through necessity in the film, where that necessity wasn't needed anymore, she stopped working. And I think that's a really interesting thing. I don't think now any film, if this film was remade, that I don't think those endings would stand true at all. I think they would be quite different for those women. I don't think that would have been the ending for the Judy character. I think it would have been quite different had it been remade again.
I think, I suppose the other two you can kind of imagine they're fair enough. I mean, Dolly Parton going off to become a huge country and western star.
Yeah, funny
I mean,
that. Yeah, amazing. What happened to Dolly Parton? You know, I haven't heard of her for years since.
Who saw that coming? But yeah, I suppose, you know, even if they'd had something like, I don't know, she'd gone off and started her own business. And I mean, these days she'd be an Instagram influencer or something like that. But I suppose that was, you know, an avenue that, yes, with the benefit of hindsight, it would have been a lot different. But I suppose we're still quite fortunate that 95% of the film was forward looking enough to kind of that most of it came true.
Yeah, I think so. I think it'd be interesting. What one thing I would say about the film is I really wish it had been directed by a woman. It was directed by a man. It was written by a woman in conjunction with others, you know, and it's the concept was a female concept. And as you said towards the beginning, you know, the production of it, there was heavy involvement from Jane Fonda, for example, and real camaraderie and kind of real... a real co-production element to it, you know, in terms of the way the idea was born with the leads and the you know, the filmmakers. But yeah, I think it would have been interesting to have been made by a woman. I think in 1980 that wouldn't have happened, and I think if it was further on, potentially, you know, that having a female director would have been the natural choice for a film like this, just to add that kind of extra layer of kind of the female point of view on what was actually a very female film. You know, it would be interesting if it was made again, you know, or, you know, a film like this, what it would be like and how the characters would be drawn with that different involvement and with a female perspective.
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing you do notice. And again, I think even Steel Magnolias was directed by a man as well, although I think he'd been involved in the whole formation of the story and everything. Yeah, it was kind of his baby from start to finish, and it was inspired partly by a true story. But yeah, I suppose, I mean, you'd like to think there's a reason, and I imagine that perhaps that there was a reason behind the decision. I guess, you know, and again, times have changed, and perhaps 40 years ago that there weren't, you know, if they're still trying to finance this film, I suppose studios or whatever would still look about, you know, such base things as could we get a woman director to do this and still make money, you know, down to, you know, it's always down to the bottom line, isn't it? But,
well, I think even having three female leads would have been really controversial at that time, you know, in 1980, to say, well, actually, most of your cast is female. You've got one male character, but he's a right idiot. And, you know, it's kind of, I don't think that would have been an easy sell to the studio, to be honest, which is probably why Jane Fonda had to fight so much to get the film made.
Yeah, and I mean, I did read, again, sort of skimming through some of the IMDb trivia for it, and it was again, this is slightly subjective when it says the first female-dominated film to gross $100 million. But when you look at, you know, some of the other films that came out around this time, I mean, we're talking 1981, you know, really up against some huge films. I mean, to make $100 million in 1981, or certainly the end of 1980, is massive. And I guess when you look at that now, and it's a wonder why they haven't remade it. And I guess apparently they had a TV show that did quite well, but I never saw it.
No, I didn't see that.
Yeah,
I think, yeah, it's interesting you talk about, you know, the female characters and of the time, you know, we still would have been unusual in 1980 to have a female dominated film. But it's really interesting. It's probably a whole other podcast where you look back in time. So I'm, you know, I'm really into kind of my 1940s and 30s and 1950s films particularly. And, you know, the number of Hollywood films where there absolutely is a female lead within those films. So you look at Katharine Hepburn's work and similar actresses at the time who played comedy so well. You know, you have your screwball comedies and you have these wonderful films that are dominated by these strong female leads within them. And it's interesting how that changed over time and then starts to reverse again kind of when you come into the 80s, because you find possibly from the influence of something like 9 to 5 that actually that does work, and that is a good sell for the studio, that you can have a film that does well with a strong female in a lead role. And you get a lot of those, I think, in the 80s, and I'm sure you've covered them on the podcast, where you have not necessarily all female kind of lineup, which you think is unusual with 9 to 5, but you have strong female characters played really well and played for comedy and played for laughs and absolutely kind of turning it around again.
I did have plans to do an episode about Working Girl soon, which I haven't. I have seen it, but not for a very long time. And you kind of think, like, without poo-pooing that or watching it, you know, you kind of feel like that the whole premise of that was there was, you know, it is a kind of the rise of a female employee, and there is a female boss at the top of it who's actually making things difficult.
Yeah,
oversimplifying it massively, but again, you kind of think like, you know, would those things be different if 9 to 5 hadn't come along, and whether to give it that much credit to change cinema, but certainly to make things a lot easier, and to, you know, if this film makes $100 million in 1980, 1981, how many studio bosses are going to think, "Ooh, hello, we're onto something here."
Absolutely. I think you're right. I think it was a real shift, you know, with this film. And it's really important, you know, as a film, people forget about it and, you know, kind of, but how it really did change things. And it was such a novel concept to have, you know, a female driven plot at the time, and to have those strong women in those roles. And I think it really did set the bar a lot higher for the studios to start to think about this. And yeah, it was definitely a game changer, I think.
Coming back to various other potential episodes and things like that, where you do wonder just this place, this film's role in cinema, and having that where, you know, you're bringing those together. And I guess, you know, this era of lacking of originality or anything else, you do wonder why there must be a reason this hasn't been remade or repurposed for a modern age. I mean, I suppose it must be difficult if you're going to remake it. What can you possibly do?
Yeah. Other than, I don't think you can't add to it. I don't think that's the problem. It's such a kind of iconic film. And again, going back to kind of a circular arc, back to the, you know, we talked about the theme song, you know, even that in itself, you know, to have a song right at the heart of the films, you know, really kind of something you really strongly identify with, again, was something quite new, that you kind of go into the 80s and kind of have that. I think I can only think in kind of the before that, in the 70s, the James Bond films and their song, you know, the way music was used. But to have such an iconic theme tune, which really sets the tone of a film, with Dolly Parton's kind of 9 to 5 as a song, it was a great pop song as well. You know, it's kind of, yeah, it kind of, everything about the film, I think, just really came together, and it just, it was kind of a real shift, I think.
I sent you a couple of things on Twitter before we recorded. I won't go into too much detail to save people's embarrassment, but when I've mentioned podcasting about this movie before, funnily enough, you know, I get the odd reply of people who found this film nasty. The concept was mean to the man. And they kind of, oh, this film wouldn't get made if it was the other way round. Yeah, it probably wouldn't, because it wouldn't be different. You know,
it wouldn't
that's
be necessary.
The whole point.
Yeah,
that's the whole point, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It wouldn't be necessary because they're obviously completely missing the point of it, is that it wouldn't be necessary because there isn't that kind of, the dynamic is completely different, and it's kind of, yeah, it's I saw those messages, and I found them quite amusing, that way of thinking is still out there, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's easy to think if you know, people of a certain background or whatever life experience, but I can't imagine who would want to see a film if the roles were reversed. I mean, there are probably some people out there who would, but
a little niche group of people, I'm sure.
Yeah, not the sort of niche I'd be looking to cater to for example. But I mean, fair play, you know, not everyone is going to like this film, and that's absolutely fine. You know, not, there are a lot of films I've watched that I haven't liked, and that no one's judging. But yeah, I think even for me, and the first message I got was before I'd watched the film, even though I had the sort of three-line blurb of what it was about. And I kind of just thought that probably says more about you than it says about the film.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah.
If you think like that, maybe you need to rewatch it again.
Yeah, I bet they haven't even seen it.
Probably not. They probably thought, oh, these women. Shaking their fist.
I know, they'll be wanting the vote next, won't they? Honestly.
Jesus. Anyway, on that bombshell, we best get this rewound before we get charged a late fee. I don't know if the video shop opens from 9 to 5 either. Maybe, but you know, a Betamax video club should have more flexible working hours for the employees and not charging people to rewind and all that stuff. Now, Anna, thank you very much for coming along again.
Thank you.
Now, do you want to tell us, for those who didn't listen to or didn't hear the Gregory's Girl episode or are new to the podcast, what can people expect if they find you on social media and your writings in the wider world?
Okay, so I write about film largely, and kind of, I guess, specialise in 50s and kind of mid-20th century film, but not always. So at the moment, I'm concentrating on writing a book about a strong female. I'm writing a biography of Dinah Dawes at the moment. So really enjoying that, and that should be out next year. So I've been concentrating heavily on that, which has been wonderful, but also kind of writing for various film magazines and publications and websites, which I always enjoy, and having conversations on Twitter with people about films, which I absolutely love.
And if anyone has got any issues about the film, maybe I can send them your way and you can teach them some manners, perhaps.
Absolutely, and I can do a PowerPoint presentation, absolutely. yeah, fine, absolutely, send them my way.
We'll get a creche installed for your daughter as well. So
yeah, of course, yeah.
Yeah.
She can probably tell them too, actually.
Oh, good, yeah. Well, that she can look after mine while she's there. Well, that was 9 to 5. Now, of course, that famous iconic theme will have been what you heard when you opened your podcast player and pressed play. But as we normally finish, the song that was number one in the UK when this film came out, which was on the 27th of March 1981, was Jealous Guy by Roxy Music. So, again, not a bad vintage. Yeah, maybe Jealous Guy in this film might go together quite well, actually. It's almost like I designed it. Anyway, Anna, thank you very much for coming along.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
And we'll speak to you again soon.
See you soon. Bye.
And my heart beating fast, I began to lose control. I began to lose control. I didn't mean to hurt. I'm sorry that I made you cry. I didn't mean to hurt you. I'm just a jealous guy. I was feeling insecure.
This podcast is brought to you by executive producer Gary West, Fergus Higginson, Keith Foster, Jimmy Fletcher, Mark Drakes, Matt Cunnington, Christian Dees, Chris Hopkins, Omar Zambon, Ian Madrill, Katrin Lowe, Mark Makin, Zoltan Vargo, Simon Smith, Laurie Curran, Wayne McNally, Darren Hodgkins, Dan Wellington, Alex Heal, Philip Rothenberger, and Alan Viewings, Associate Producer Chris Oakley. Visit patreon.com/BMX Video Club for more information about bonus episodes, early access, discounted merchandise, and more.